Welcome to Hack the Entrepreneur, the show which reveals the fears, habits, and inner battles behind big-name entrepreneurs and those on their way to joining them. Now here is your host, John Naster.
Hey, hey, this is Hack the Entrepreneur. Thank you so much for joining me yet again today. I truly appreciate it, as I hope that you know. If you've never been here before, welcome to the show. I hope you enjoy it. I hope you get everything out of it that you're hoping for. And I hope that we'll see you back here again. So today's interview went, I'm going to say about 20 minutes longer than they typically do because it was just too good, too interesting. And honestly, in the 500 episodes that we've done nearly, it is completely different and a completely different business than we've yet to cover. So let's just get into it, shall we? My guest today is the co-founder of Riot Games, which is the company behind the worldwide gaming sensation League of Legends. Now, if you aren't into gaming and you don't quite know the scale or magnitude that they've reached with League of Legends, as of now, the beginning of 2020, League of Legends has over 100 million monthly users. But back in 2005, my guest and his co-founder were just typical college roommates going to class playing video games and dreaming up ways to transform the gaming industry. Their idea was to develop a game that would only make money selling virtual goods within the game itself. The two of them are non-technical co-founders, so they needed to put together a team who could make their dream a reality. They spent the next 12 months mapping out a business plan, overcoming every obstacle that they could find or think of, and found funding to start building their team. They officially launched in 2006, and then a marathon of building a successful game began. After 4 years of pushing the project forward, they sold 94% of Riot Games for $400 million. But they've since kept working on Riot Games as co-chairman, CEO, and many changing titles throughout. As of today, they're both co-founders and co-chairman of the company known as Riot Games. This is a great conversation. And there's just a lot to be gleaned from this. So I hope you enjoy this as much as I did. Now, let's hack. Mark Merrill. I want you to think back. Do you remember when you started your small business? It was no small feat, was it? No, it took a lot of late nights, early mornings, and the occasional all-nighter. Bottom line, you've been insanely busy ever since. So why not make things a little easier on yourself? Well, our friends at FreshBooks are going to help you out, and they have the solution. FreshBooks invoicing and accounting software is designed specifically for small business owners. It's simple, intuitive, and keeps you way more organized than that dusty shoebox filled with crumpled receipts. Create and send professional-looking invoices in 30 seconds, and then get paid 2 times faster with automated online payments. You can file expenses even quicker, and you'll keep them perfectly organized for tax time. The best part of all this? FreshBooks grows alongside your business, so you'll always have the tools you need when you need them, without ever having to learn the ins and outs of accounting. Join the 24 million people who have used FreshBooks. Try it for free for 30 days. No catch, no credit card required. Go to freshbooks.com/hack and enter Hack the Entrepreneur in the How Did You Hear About Us section. Once again, freshbooks.com/hack. We are back with another episode of Hack the Entrepreneur. And today we have a very, very, very special guest. Mark, welcome to the show.
Thanks, John. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Absolutely. My pleasure. I'm looking forward to this. So let's just jump into it.
Sure.
Mark, let's start here. As an entrepreneur, can you tell me, what's the one thing that you do that you feel has been the biggest contributor to your successes so far?
So I think that there's obviously a lot of things that go into having an individual or an entrepreneur be successful. But I think that a couple of the practices that have probably been, that I sort of recognized over time have been most thematic in my success and in Riot's approach to how we do things is, one, I've always really tried to put the sort of the customer in our world, we call them the player, really in the center of all of our decision making. And so Riot's mission is that we aspire to be the most player-focused game company in the world. And, you know, I think on a personal note, my business partner, Brandon, and I, you know, we founded Riot Games because we as players and as gamers felt really underserved by, you know, a lot of the industry offerings at the time. We loved online games. We loved really playing few games very deeply rather than just buying lots of games and playing sort of at a surface level. And the business model at the time in sort of the early 2000s was, you know, more akin to the packaged good business where game publishers would create games to be on a shiny disc that you would sell at retail. And that led to lots of situations where we as players felt like we were being deprioritized over, say, the need to go sell another shiny disc with additional sequels or additional features or things like that in a new version of kind of the same game. And so from our perspective, we're like, hey, why don't we go create or try to create what we perceive to be sort of the game company of the future, where we establish a direct relationship with our players and we nurture a community and sort of build this relationship where we can evolve a game and an experience and a community in conjunction with them. And so I think we've really learned over time to both have more confidence in trusting our intuition as players, but then trying to have the discipline of, so sort of another contributor to our success, I think, was one, starting with the player perspective, but then two, trying to be sufficiently intellectually honest where we try to validate our own assumptions. We assume we don't have a monopoly on truth, and we try to surround ourselves with a great team and great individuals who can complement our strengths and challenge the various decisions that are being made to help us get to the right answer. Because at the end of the day, we'd rather be successful than not successful. And so as part of that, one of our beliefs was that it's better to get to the right answer than it is to be right. And so that's totally fine, acknowledging when you're wrong or there are mistakes, and that's the only way you can sort of learn and evolve. And so I think those are two things that were really important for us, you know, putting players at the center of our decision making, and then, you know, two, constantly evaluating decisions and getting good at critical thinking and building a great team.
Wow. Okay, cool. I like that. So this is 2006 when you found Riot Games, correct?
Mm-hmm.
You and Brandon. So with this player focus and you guys being players, you're also in business school, I believe.
So Brandon, we both went to USC together, and okay. I was undecided for 2 years and was a liberal arts guy, did political science and psychology. And Brandon was a business major. We both assumed that we'd go get an MBA later in life, and then, you know, never really had time to do it because we started Riot when we were 24 and 25 years old.
Wow. Okay. Fair enough. So this idea of putting the player first, I mean, that's obviously been around in business for a long time, just mm-hmm. putting the customer first. But having this like the player focus and then wanting to sort of change the way the business model works in a massive industry, how does this come about to you that this is what needs to happen and the two of us who are not developers at all should do this?
Yeah, so I think the way that we thought about the world was that we kind of recognized, we really had two hats. We had kind of the business hat where we could look at the industry, the opportunity that we saw from sort of a strategic and analytical and sort of quantifiable business perspective. And then the other hat that we could look at the situation was from a player hat perspective, where we could understand how the industry dynamics felt from an emotional perspective as an end user. And I think that it was really both perspectives that were critical in coming up with the business plan and idea for Riot and the business model for League of Legends that I think was a key decision that helped League become as successful as it has. And a lot of that related to the incentive structure where developed because of the business model at the time of selling games at retail to justify another $60 box, the incentive structure for developers after they shipped an incredible game such as, say, StarCraft, right? Or game like Warcraft 3 or whatnot. Two games from Blizzard that Brandon and I played a ton of that are incredible games. But the challenge is because the business model at the time was really oriented around big $60 price point, the development team didn't have a financial incentive to continue to invest in these games that had these really robust, incredible multiplayer communities that were built around them. And, you know, if you asked players a lot of times, and this is not a critique of Blizzard whatsoever, again, they're my favorite developer of all time. This is more just examples that pointed to a broader industry challenge. They had these really robust multiplayer communities that were saying, no, don't move the development team off of this game to go create the next iteration or StarCraft 2 or et cetera. We want more of the same game. So please add more features or things like that. Players wouldn't, of course, articulate it in exactly those words, but the feeling that we felt was that a lot of these games, there was a lot more that could be done. And so we were also playing a lot of games at the time, whether it's EverQuest or World of Warcraft or Counter-Strike or, you know, Ultima Online before that. And MMOs, or massive multiplayer online games, were the one genre of games at the time that had a service-oriented business model, typically a subscription, where they could generate recurring revenue. And those games did a much better job than many other multiplayer games at continuing to add content, continuing to invest in features, and building a relationship with players. And so our thought, you know, and belief was that a lot of where opportunity would be in the future was as other games started transition to the service-oriented model. And so League of Legends was the sort of content thesis or proof point for us to demonstrate to ourselves and to our investors that that's a better way to align the incentives of players with what the developers and or the publishers would want. And then the business model of making a game free was sort of a natural byproduct of that philosophy, where it's like, hey, if we really believe that no one should pay us until they're having a great experience, but if they do, right, let's not necessarily cap how much they can spend in the game, essentially just leveraging the economic principle of price discrimination, then that seemed like a good alignment of interest, but from both a company and from a player perspective. And in Asia, in particular in Korea and in China, this business model had already started to emerge. And part of the reason that that was the case is because piracy in those markets was so efficient. Everybody could essentially pirate any game that had a price point, that the only way that game companies could actually make money was shifting to the service-oriented model and have a sort of a digital goods-based model. And a lot of those games were growing rapidly and doing very well. And so from our perspective, we're like, hey, this is where a lot of the opportunity is, because it's just a better thing for players. And so, you know, so it's really that dual perspective, I think, that helped give us the conviction to take the plunge or the leap, so to speak, because, you know, every other company had the same access to the same information, but it was really the willingness to weight that player perspective very highly in our decision making that I think, and that we weren't an incumbent, right? We didn't have years of company infrastructure built around sort of a best practice and sort of a current advantage around packaged goods. We had the advantage, so to speak, of building a new company from scratch, sort of working backwards from these first principles. And that's essentially what Riot became.
So you have this business model idea. You've solidified it from like the business model sort of perspective and then the player perspective. You bring it to your investors because you want to get started in this. At what point in this story or timeline, Mark, does League of Legends exist, or the idea of what you're going to create as League of Legends?
Sure. So the way that we raised money was we initially did an angel round where Brandon and I, to your point earlier, you know, we were 24 and 25. We weren't engineers. You know, we had no professional software development background. And so we recognized that we would have a massive credibility hurdle with investors, you know, for one, and two, we really had no idea or expertise around how to actually go build what we were trying to build. But we had pretty strong conviction in terms of sort of the vision around if we did something in these ways, again, from player, with our player hat on, we think it could be great. And so then we had the challenge of working backwards from that vision that we had conviction in to be like, all right, how do we go attract capital? How do we go build a team that can actually go execute on this? How do we train ourselves? And if we do these things, would it actually work? So we kicked off kind of a 9-month nights and weekends analysis of the opportunity, putting together the business plan, and then ultimately going on a roadshow where we started to go talk to angel investors in and around the LA area predominantly. And this was in early 2006. The market was doing pretty well and things like that. So, you know, I think there were a lot of private individuals that were looking to deploy capital in, you know, in the internet space in particular. because after the bubble had burst, the internet bubble in sort of 2001, things had started to rebound, and I think a lot of people had interest. And so we put together a 15-slide pitch deck that tried to, as concisely as possible, explain the thesis that we had in terms of what we were doing and why it would work. And then we had about 200 slides of an appendix that would try to anticipate every question a potential investor would have about how we'd execute, what the problems would be, certain aspects of the market dynamics, you know, et cetera. So when somebody would say, hey, like, I vaguely understand what you guys are trying to do and that sounds compelling, but what about X? That's a great question. If you were conferred a slide 174 at exhibit 72, we can see this. And the whole thought process there was trying to demonstrate that we were highly prepared, that we were very thoughtful. And that was the result, not just of us trying to demonstrate that we were thoughtful, but of course, we went through a great amount of diligence ourselves because we also didn't want to delude ourselves trying to go chase an opportunity that we had no real actual opportunity to go achieve or no business trying to go achieve. And so, because we didn't want to delude ourselves. And so a lot of this preparation over the 9 months while we were working at our respective careers, I think was critical to help us get conviction around how to approach it. We, of course, once we started to operate, still made every mistake you could possibly think of. But I think it was a really, really important point for us. And it drove a mindset of being, having a great attention to detail, validating our own assumptions, trying to be thorough from a quality decision-making standpoint to not waste our time, not waste other people's time. Because as every entrepreneur knows, that, you know, that raises money, it's an incredibly stressful thing when you're taking other people's money to bet on you and you're going and you have a fixed amount of it to go try to achieve a whole bunch of things. And so we raised an angel round that was a pretty big angel round at the time. It was about $1.5 million. And that was to start to really build the team, build a prototype, and to start making progress to potentially getting venture ready. And that was when League of Legends started to become a thing, essentially. So, you know, originally it didn't even have the name League of Legends. You know, our first working prototype was called Onslaught. You know, we built a little video and a demo for it. And we were pursuing a parallel financing strategy post-Angels, where we were talking to both publishers in the industry, but then also to VCs. And once we started talking to publishers, it quickly eliminated that option for us as a funding source, because all of the incumbent publishers that we talked to really did not believe in our vision, where we're saying, yeah, the game's going to be free. You know, there's going to be no single player. A lot of things that were the staples of the industry at the time, we weren't going to do. And so it just made sense that everybody would look at that and be like, this doesn't make any sense. It's not the type of approach that we see. And therefore, it's not the type of approach that we fund. And in hindsight, you know, it's sort of now recognized that when you're an outlier trying to do something pretty different than a particular industry, that's a very common thing. But as an entrepreneur, hearing no over and over and over and hearing a lot of the industry experts criticize what you're trying to do and why, that's a difficult thing to overcome. And so again, I think it was really helpful to have the preparation that we did, where we really tried to rip it apart. And that, you know, I think it was critical that Brandon and I had each other as business partners, because it can be a very lonely journey as an entrepreneur, as everybody knows. And some days you feel like you can take over the world, and other days felt like, oh my God, how are we going to possibly overcome these challenges that we face? And so it, the early days are always tough.
Right. And to go into like the having the business partner, especially like a business partner who like took business and then you took like political science and psychology, I think you said, or philosophy. I mean, having those different perspectives is helpful because you're not just both thinking the same thing. You can kind of like catch each other when you maybe go off track in your thinking. Sure. But when you're sitting down to say, create this 200-page appendix of questions and answers, everything you could possibly be asked, like you were literally just thinking of anything that you could ask about the game or about the business model and then answering it for yourself?
Pretty much. So we tried to put ourselves into the shoes of a credible, skeptical investor that would come up with the reasons as to why not to invest, right? Or why this couldn't work. You know, and then we would essentially work backwards from those questions to say, what is a good answer to this question, right? And is it true, right? Like, so when we think about why we can execute, right? How do we sort of build the case about how development is evolving and demonstrate our high-level understanding of development from a team or industry advisor perspective? How do we help tell the story, but not just tell the story, but then also go build the relationships necessary with various individuals where we're recognizing that we have skills gaps or competency gaps or information gaps to go ensure that we do not have those gaps anymore. So it wasn't just building the deck. It was essentially acknowledging where we potentially had weakness and then going to try to fill in those gaps with real solutions, right? Or at least something that could lead to a particular solution. And I think that the acknowledging of the gaps was something that was very important and helpful for us. And again, not just to raise money, but much more importantly, to actually become a successful company, because we needed to build a lot of competency in order to pull off what we were doing. So we thought it was going to take us $3 million to build League of Legends and get to the market. It ended up costing us 20. We thought it would take a much shorter amount of time. We thought we could get more technology and from both a game engine perspective, as well as from a platform sort of scalable enterprise solution perspective than actually existed sort of an off-the-shelf middleware market at the time. And so a lot of these, you know, so once we really got into the nitty-gritty of operating, we recognized that even with the diligence in advance didn't mean that we answered these questions fully sufficiently. But the approach to recognize where the challenges were helpful, because then we could, of course, allocate effort and or go build teams or continue to build competencies if the first solution or the first assumptions that we had weren't actually working, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it absolutely does. It's surprising how much sense it makes, like how sort of thoughtfully and trying to be like that, like honest with yourself going into it rather than just trying to like, I just feel this in my gut, this is going to work. And just like people typically try and find reasons to do things all the time rather than try and find reasons why people won't want to do it with you and then solve those problems in advance.
Right. I think that's a great way to say it. And in our experience, it's a massive risk to delude yourself, you know, because like, we also don't think that we can really sell something unless we really believe in it. And that hurdle to really believe in something should be high, where you, to your point, develop conviction through the preparation and through the analysis and through being thoughtful and through sort of building your frame of reference for what are the industry experts doing? How do other companies do things? And again, why would this different approach still work, even if it hasn't necessarily been done before in exactly the way that you're thinking about it? And so I think that that experience has really resonated with us or become more sort of entrenched over time, and not just through the founding and creation of the company, but through scaling of the company and through expanding into different areas. Because one of the things that has, of course, happened with Riot and League of Legends is we've helped really invest quite a bit in the growth of esports. And there's a variety of sort of areas of innovation where there were lots of similar dynamics, where there were a lot of skeptics, the industry hadn't supported sort of esports the way that we believed that they had the potential to do in the future. And we applied the same approach, this time with a much larger team and, you know, with more stakeholders involved. We sort of worked backwards from the, again, vision around, wouldn't it be cool if players could join professional teams and it was easy to be a fan, and fans would come watch games being played in these live arenas with thousands of people online. It sounds a little crazy when you rewind, you know, 10, 15 years. But again, when we put on our player hat, and once we had a game like League of Legends that had launched and was highly competitive, and we were on the market at the same time that streaming technology with companies like Twitch was really becoming more ubiquitous, it really helped create the dynamics that, where it's like, of course this hasn't happened before at scale, but that doesn't mean it can't necessarily happen now. And so how can we go validate our own assumptions with some experiments? And so the first season of League of Legends, when we launched competitive play, we did some small third-party tournaments, culminating in a large global championship in Jönköping, Sweden. And we had folding chairs, and it was a very small budget, and it was sort of in an airplane hangar of this bring-your-own-computer convention. It was really not high production value, but despite that, over 1 million players tuned in to watch, right? And from our perspective, that then validated that there was a lot of players like us who wanted to go experience these things and gave us license to go invest even bigger. I think that we had a sort of a similar approach to building league to then building, you know, or to helping to invest in esports. And hopefully we're trying to apply that same perspective for other things that we're doing as the company continues to grow.
Wow. So, yeah. And so, I mean, from 2006 to 2020, I mean, the video game industry has transformed itself, I think, and just like exponentially grown. And again, I don't even know that much about it because it seems to me, like as somebody who's interested in business and markets, video game, and I mean, I play an Xbox One all the time and stuff, but I'm not into the online playing, but it seems like this silent industry that like doesn't get like, it's not like the movie industry or the music industry that gets all the front pages and everything. Yet the video game industry, from what I understand, is like surpassing them in just in the amount of dollars that are going through it and the amount of people just involved in players that are playing worldwide.
Yeah, for sure. And I think a lot of that relates to, again, the sort of infrastructure of industry dynamics that exist currently that have been built up to support a sort of a media market that is rapidly changing. And so in a lot of ways, esports or League of Legends or various games that have achieved a lot of success, I think they're getting more attention now than they really used to. But on a comparative basis, to your point, to sort of big Hollywood films or things like that, especially from an economic standpoint, definitely not as front and center or getting the headlines despite massive engagement numbers and revenue numbers and things like that. But a lot of that just, we don't think that reflects, you know, poorly on the industry per se, or that maybe the content isn't great or things like that. But to us, it's just a demographic divide where people that grow up with video games tend to play games throughout their whole lives. But, and, you know, there's still many people who didn't necessarily play games or the types of games that are generating a lot of engagement. And so as a result, the media landscape will have organizations that are news desks that are focused around, like maybe they have a tech beat reporter, or they have sort of like a business reporter or whatnot, and a media reporter or a desk. But oftentimes, like, who would cover Riot, right? Is it the business reporter? Maybe, you know, there's some business stories. Is it the tech reporter? You know, obviously there's a lot of incredible technology underlying what we're doing. Is it the sports reporter that should go and cover an esports event? You know, is it the media guy? And, you know, their tastes and interests and perspective also may not be oriented to the types of content that we're creating, right? It's sort of this genre bending new thing. And so, like, when we did a large event at Staples Center for the first time, and actually we did twice at Staples Center, which are World Championships, you know, when we had over, you know, I think 37 million people watch it live at that point in time. Last year, when we were in Paris, we had close to 100 million players watch it live. The LA Times didn't even send a reporter to come check us out. And, you know, that's fine, right? We don't really take that as an insult per se. You know, I think it just more reflects a sort of like a more traditional company that is probably working on figuring out what is this? How do we cover it? Is it a fad? Does it even make sense? Should we adjust? And I think a lot of esports investors have looked at esports in a similar way too, where if you're a Fortune 500 CMO and you're, you know, probably over 50 years old, as an example, it is more familiar and comfortable for you to go sponsor College Game Day or the Olympics or Super Bowl, you know, create a Super Bowl ad or something, rather than something that is getting similar viewership numbers with a very attractive demographic, but that you've never heard of and can't understand why somebody would actually want to go watch somebody else play video games, because it just, that sounds so crazy to you. So we're seeing a lot of that change now, where we tend to believe that brand trails execution. So from our perspective, it's we always wanted to go do incredibly cool things and then have the results kind of speak for itself over time. But I could go into lots of stories about how that created a lot of challenges, because when we were trying to build these different leagues all around the world and we tried to partner with different organizations like ESPN to do broadcasts or things like that, again, lots of the parties that we would love to partner with, again, didn't have the necessary conviction to invest or build the competencies necessary to go cover things in a way, again, that we thought as players would be the right way to deliver the fan experience. And so that meant that Riot had to then go cultivate these expertise and go build a lot of these competencies in-house in order to go deliver on where we saw the opportunity. And And now over time, I think the ecosystem is changing because there's more proof points in the market. There's a bunch of successful esports games. The viewership numbers are going like crazy. Sponsors are getting more involved. Big brands are starting to figure it out. But it's just that works backwards from after there's an audience that is starting to really attach. And I think that the media landscape will follow a similar dynamic where I bet, and if we fast forward 10 years, there's going to be a very significant journalism component that is actually not only covering just esports or video games, but actively what players are doing within games. So virtual world exploits will start to become newsworthy items in a way that, again, for to me and to other gamers, I think is really exciting. But you know, that we kind of already know, but the way we get access to those news channels or whatnot is through YouTube or through forums or through a lot of immature spaces. But as games continue to grow and grow and grow, I think that that those channels will evolve.
Right, exactly. And I just want to clarify, like, I wasn't in any way like saying it in a derogatory way. I actually find it fascinating, and it's almost like you're an underdog who's actually bigger than lots of the other industries, but you're still treated like an underdog. And I think, like, to me, I come from skateboarding, and to me, it was kind of like nice. Skateboarding took forever to become, even it got into the Olympics and people still sort of like, well, that's not really a sport. And skateboarding never got to the level of video games, and obviously won't, because just gaming's taking off and will continue to.
I think you're exactly right. So one, I didn't take it in a derogatory fashion. And two, I think there's a lot of different niche communities, whether it's, you know, skateboarding and sort of the X Games or even music genres that I think follow similar patterns, such as punk or EDM or whatnot, where they kind of start as these underground things. But then as the communities continue to grow, as the identity of people who would love these communities continues to solidify, and there's these different rules of behavior that start to evolve and these norms, whatnot, you know, they can become these really lasting things and these really special communities that for people that are into them absolutely love them. And I think games very much do have a lot of the same or similar dynamics there. It's just because of the barrier to entry now for online games is becoming so low. All you need is a phone or a PC or a tablet computer or whatnot and an internet connection. And you can plug into these incredibly cool, vibrant communities where really amazing things are happening. That's really neat. And especially when there's incentive for players to bring in their friends to share in their joy together, that helps it grow virally. And so as technology infrastructure continues to evolve, the ability for great games to spread sort of increases exponentially. And then also, again, with sort of supporting dynamics like YouTube, where content creators can have an economic incentive to go be the journalists of this space or the comedians of this space, or similarly on Twitch TV, where people can do things in real time. It's like all of these different facets of the industry are mirroring traditional industries, but it's just approached in a very different way and done in a very different way. But it's serving the same human needs that have been addressed by lots of different forms of media or sports or communities all throughout human history.
Yeah, it's addressing the same needs, but doing it in a way that you can choose where you belong, rather than these are the 12 channels that are on TV.
Right.
You want to watch TV tonight? This is what you're watching.
Great point. Well, and that's one of the things I think that is also really great is that competition really benefits the consumer. And in a world where distribution is more commoditized, right, where the switching cost between one platform to another is very, very, very low, the value continues to shift upstream to people want to go play the best stuff or they want to go watch the best stuff. Like, why would somebody subscribe to HBO? Because they love Game of Thrones, right? Typically, it's not because of some deep affinity for HBO, although I'm sure that that happens over time. It's like content. People oftentimes say content is king. And so in our world, you know, Riot has been tried to be built from the ground up to be a company that can go build incredible content experiences, right? And, you know, in our sort of internal vocabulary, you know, we say try to make impossible dreams for players come true. And that's a really exciting, fun thing. And I think that's why it's so important for us to cultivate an incredible place to work where people can come and have the opportunity to do their best work, that want to go tackle the hardest problems in the gaming space, that want to think big and want to do things differently. Because unless we have an environment like that where we can get the best people and create the best teams, we can't go build the best experiences for players. And we believe that the way we create shareholder value or whatnot is by doing that. Starts with building an incredible team, starts with building great experiences for players. And if we have the right business model and whatnot, then players will reward us with revenue. And so we look at revenue as a trailing indicator. And then an outcome will be growing shareholder value. But the goal is not, let's go maximize shareholder value. There's a lot of sort of a much broader set of stakeholders that we think about and consider.
So I see that your title now is co-chairman of Riot Games. Mm-hmm. What does that make like your day-to-day within the company look like?
So it's interesting. My title has evolved a couple times in the history of the company. So I was president and chief marketing officer, and then I was president and executive producer, and then I became co-CEO. And then now, about a year and a half ago, my business partner, Brandon Beck, and I stepped aside and elevated an internal leadership team to manage day-to-day operations for the company. And so now we're sort of co-chairmans and co-founders. And really what that means is that I think that Brandon and I are, we can best add value to the company when we are focused on things like the sort of soul of the organization, our culture, or the purpose that what we're trying to do for players, and or thinking strategically about where things are going 3, 5, 10 years out and helping the company tackle those opportunities. But it's this interesting dual role where from a board perspective, right, one of the most important things that a chairman does is hire the CEO. And so we, in a weird way, the leadership team and the CEO is accountable to us and to the board. But then when we're operating within the business, when we're putting on our co-founder hat and we're getting involved in product or we're getting involved in marketing activity or publishing or some culture work or education internally, we're accountable to our CEO. And I actually think that it works really well. And I think part of the thesis behind it is, again, let's focus on what we're great at, what we can add the most value to the organization with, and vice versa. And so, I think, so our new CEO, or it's not that new anymore, about a year and a half ago, it's a guy named Niccolo Laurent, and he ran international business for us, helped us expand all across the world. He's been at Riot for now, I think 10 or 11 years, and really helped grow the organization alongside of us. And, our former CFO is our president, a guy named Dylan Jadeja, and then there's a whole executive team now that has helped mature and professionalize the company from an operating perspective and from a planning perspective. And we think that that's incredibly necessary. But what's also very necessary is that as Riot sort of evolves to become more the incumbent, that we still try to have this sort of obsession for the front lines, that we recognize that our only differentiating factor that really matters is our ability to connect with our players, is the ability to empathize with them and utilize that deep knowledge and conviction to help inform the different activities that we're doing or areas that we're going to invest in, or products that we'll create in the future. And, so those are the types of activities that we're focused on. And from a day-to-day standpoint, our scope of work can vary greatly from doing internal presentations or bringing in outside speakers to fireside chats or doing portfolio or product reviews or doing mentoring or coaching sessions. And then also we're trying to get more flexibility. So my wife is an entrepreneur. We have 2 kids that are 5 and 6. As every entrepreneur knows, it's an exhausting thing being a business leader and being involved in a fast-growing startup. Not to mention if you have dual income and 2 working parents and with young kids. And so trying to get more balance in my life and recover a little bit. And we used to have this metaphor where we'd say that we have to pace ourselves because it's a marathon, not a sprint. And I've amended that over time to say, actually, I think we recognize that it's a series of infinite consecutive sprints and I think it's more descriptive because when you're working hard in the startup, I mean, you work oftentimes really, really hard, and the separation between work and life is oftentimes nigh impossible, which then means that is unsustainable. And any sprinter knows that when you're going incredibly hard, incredibly fast, you can't sprint infinitely. You need recovery time. You need to do intervals. You need to rest. And I think that's a better metaphor for humans that are involved in fast growing startups or entrepreneurs, because eventually there is a breaking point. And so there's a whole bunch of goals in terms of why we've shuffled roles and responsibilities, but it's, you know, from our perspective, it's working out really well. And hopefully, you know, Riot is really just getting started.
Yeah. And that, so coming from literally from just this idea while in school and trying to create this thing, I just want to know, as like a co-chairman now and somebody, obviously you could, I'm sure, walk away if you wanted to at this point, but how does it feel, the fact that you have like 100 million monthly users or some insane amount, that you can now, like, this isn't a drawing board where you guys have to sit down for like 16 months or 18 months just to build something that somebody can finally see. Like, you can now implement something in the product or something on the community side that literally is like, you can get feedback on it instantly with the volume. Like, how does that feel? And is that addicting at all?
So yes, I do think it is addicting. and, but I would argue it's sort of in a good way, because what's great now is, as obviously opposed to when we were just getting started and nobody knew about us or heard about us, now anything that we create sort of can instantaneously hit critical mass. And so we have one of the largest digital distribution sort of platforms and sort of connections of players all around the planet. And that's a great advantage, but it means that anything that we create will be seen by lots of people. Therefore, it reinforces that the most important thing we can possibly do is create things that are great. And that is a difficult responsibility, because it's easy to go chase a bunch of pretty good ideas. And Riot is probably the largest game company in the history of our industry to only have one game. Although now technically we have two with Teamfight Tactics, and on the 24th, we're about to go into open beta with the Legends of Runeterra. So the S in Riot Games is no longer becoming aspirational. We're actually shifting to a multi-product company. But for 10 years, we were really focused on League of Legends as the one product that we had live. And a lot of people were highly critical of that approach. But our perspective was that was really, really important to the company's success, where all we had to do was put our player hat on and to see all of the different ways we were letting down League players, or ways that we could improve the game, or features that really needed to continue to be added or iterated on or whatnot. And that commitment that we have felt and still feel to League and to League players is really, really deep and really important. And we aspire to bring that same level of conviction and attention to every game that we create. But it's very difficult to do, because to your point, when you have a lot of resources, you have a massive global distribution footprint, it's easy to go be like, let's go do lots of things. But a lot of things aren't necessarily what players really want. Our view is that the game business is really oversaturated, and the media market in general across the world is oversaturated. There's lots of different activities competing for people's time and attention, whether it's lots of games people buy on their Steam library or on their iTunes account or on Google Play or on their Xbox, whatnot. People oftentimes don't play, they don't allocate the hours to a lot of these games that they even like to in their mind's eye, even if they spend some money. And so our view is, let's not continue to contribute to a lot of this noise. Let's focus on things that are highly differentiated, that are worth people's time. And that's a very high bar, and that's a very difficult thing to do. But that's what we've been trying to do. And so a lot of that reinforces or creates the need to create great internal discipline and great belief and buy-in from all corners of the organization about the need to focus and about why the strategy makes sense. Especially because as a game developer, right, you want to make games. You've got great ideas. You want to go make a lot of things. And so managing that dynamic has always been hard. But the beauty of it is, to your point, you know, when we do create something, it'll get everybody's attention. And that's a tremendous luxury, but we try to reinforce that is a luxury that we need to continue to fight tooth and nail to continue to earn every day, because we're really talking about player trust. It's not just distribution of installs on people's machines. It's their belief and desire to click on our executable to load up the game because in order to go watch content that, you know, they were creating or whatnot, because they love what we're doing. And that's an emotional response and reaction. And that's really what we need to continue to try to foster with all the experiences we create.
And probably not all positive reactions. I could just imagine, like, look at a YouTube video, put a YouTube video that gets even just 100,000 views, and the comments on there will usually make the average person cry. So on your level, like, it's, I couldn't even, like, you put something out there and obviously, like, a mass, like, most of your fans are going to love it, but there's always going to be the detractors, especially, I mean, I think not especially, but within, like, the gamer market, I mean, because it's that underground sort of feel. And so there's just communities of people talking about this stuff. And
right.
So many people are so goddamn opinionated.
Right. Well, and what the good thing about that is, I think there's a thin line between sort of love and hate, where people are passionate about it. And so therefore, when they feel like something doesn't resonate with them, or they're, or they disagree with the decision or whatnot, that passion comes out, and they, and oftentimes can be expressed verbally or through various social media platforms or whatnot. But it's way worse to be ignored, where people just don't care because you're not relevant. And that being said, right, I do imagine a world where people have learned that there are humans at the other end of these keyboards and whatnot. And, you know, a lot of things people could say can be hurtful. And it, as somebody who's a bit of a perfectionist in different areas and on behalf of teams that work really hard to create great creative experiences, it is tough to read highly critical feedback. But that being said, I really do think it is important to recognize that people are upset or angry because they love it, and they believe, it's sort of like an optimistic view where it's like they expect you to do better. And oftentimes in our experience too, it's less a reflection on the content, you know, or a different thing we've created. I mean, sometimes it, there's something that's very well deserved that gets a lot of criticism, but it's more a reflection of we didn't do a great job explaining it, or people had some assumptions that weren't necessarily true, that over time when they get into it, maybe their fears will find out that they're unwarranted. Or one other way to think about it is, like, imagine that we're at a football game, an American football game, say 100,000 person stadium, and you could be a fan of a team and a player drops a pass or makes some mistake that is very upsetting. If you had a microphone, you know, and a camera pointed at every single mouth and every single face in the entire stadium, and it recorded what they say, there's a lot of people who are fans that would be like, ah, oh, and they'd be super angry, be like, F that guy, or, you know, how could this happen? And they would say some things that they don't actually mean. Whereas if they go and meet that player at a bar after the game, they'd be thrilled. They'd be like, oh my God, there's Jerry Rice or whatever. Like, let's take a picture, or hey, could I have a selfie? So they actually have fandom, even though in their moment of intensity or emotional sort of expression, they may say something that they don't actually fully mean. I really believe that a lot of social media is like that, where, and we have a lot of data which actually supports this, because we have a very large online community. The number one reason people would leave League of Legends is because other people could be jerks. That's not our fault, but that's our problem, right? It's like if you imagine every basketball court in the planet being a metaphor for sort of League of Legends courts, if you go play a pickup game, some people are going to get aggressive. And in a real world dynamic, you have a mechanism to say, hey, like, back off a little bit, or hey, I'm sorry, or whatnot. In the online world, oftentimes those tools aren't developed. So we had to build a bunch of tools. To make a long story short, we have created a bunch of tools that really work and that demonstrate that 40% of the players are like angels. They never get angry at people. They're super supportive. And only like 0.1% of players are actual jerks that are kind of always mean to people, which I think likely reflects humanity. And then the remainder are people who everybody sometimes has a bad day. And so, you know, and then decides to take it out on somebody else in a way that's deconstructive. And so we've created automated report cards that pop up after the game when somebody gets reported for negative behavior that helps articulate to somebody what they did and why that felt bad and sort of the impact that their actions may have had on somebody else. And then 70% of people continue to play the game after they've been reported like that, and they never have that report card happen for them again. So they're actually learning and getting better, and, you know, through feedback. And so I think that there's going to be a lot more of these innovation and online systems like that that help teach people how to have higher quality human interactions. And I think game companies and other online companies are the types of companies that can help lead the way in cultivating a safer, more sportsmanlike online world. And anyway, I could go on and on about this stuff, but I think having a passionate fan base is a double-edged sword, but in general, it's a great thing. And, but it can be hurtful because we're all human.
Such a necessary healthy and constructive like perspective to take on negative feedback on something that you create and put out there. I think just like there's so many, like, because Riot is obviously you're an online company in that sense. You're not like an insurance company that was created 100 years ago and they take a bit of heat from they do something wrong or dumb and they just like get their back up and just will not admit that it's their fault ever. And for you guys to take that and be like, well, there's something to this. Like, what's the cause of this? It's not just because these people are just like that. There's other reasons.
You know, I think it's really important to create a world where redemption is possible, both for the perpetrator and for the victim in some ways, right? You know, and obviously there's a million different scenarios where those roles can be reversed. You know, but as a company, if you do something that doesn't lead to the optimal outcome that you're intending, of course you should say sorry. Of course you should take responsibility. Of course you should learn, right, and evolve. And you can't learn and evolve and grow unless you take responsibility. And even if there are reasons or it's justifiable in certain lenses or many people appreciate what you're actually trying to do, it's obviously it's nuanced and it depends on different scenarios, but we just really do believe that growth happens when there's honesty, transparency, and people acknowledge. One complication, of course, is that there's a legal system, right, which makes that highly punitive, right? If companies acknowledge something, that may create incentive for others to then come after them, even if they don't have great cases or whatnot. And so, you know, there's a lot of complications here that I think muddy the waters of what sort of good business practices or interpersonal practices could and should be. But I think when you divorce yourself from all of that and just think about how do you have high quality interactions among humans? It's always with honesty and transparency and communication and with empathy. And so we always try to get creative to be like, how do we create those types of dynamics, even though we have to live in the real world?
I love it. I love it. I just have enjoyed this conversation. It's been absolutely fascinating, Mark. But I do need to wrap up on one final question, if I could, for you.
Sure.
So it's this thing I'm working with calling the entrepreneurial gap. Seems to be this place we often live in as creators, as entrepreneurs, is that we always are projecting our own personal or business success into the future. So in 3 months, when you hit that metric that you're trying to hit, or in 6 months, when you get to like stand on that stage, whatever it happens to be, you and I both know seconds before you hit that, you're going to set bigger, loftier goals into the future. I agree to a point we need to do that, but rather than looking forward, right now, for the next couple of minutes, I would love it if you could stop and turn around and look behind you. It's been about 15 years since you came up with even starting this. I'm sure it's grown beyond, well, most people in the world's wildest dreams of what you've created. I would just love to know, how does it feel, this entire journey, but only up until this moment?
Ooh. I totally agree with your perspective. That's a habit of entrepreneurs to constantly look forward. So to answer the question on how does it feel, I think it feels a lot of different things simultaneously. And it really depends on what perspective I adopt. And one of the things that I think has been fascinating is I recognized over time, and part of this was the catalyst as to why I stepped aside also, that a lot of my drive has come from dissatisfaction. Whether it's dissatisfaction of myself personally or dissatisfaction with a particular industry or dissatisfaction with a product or a team or a process. And therefore, it's sort of an optimistic lens, though. It's, I think things could be better and I see opportunity there. Therefore, let's go drive on it. The challenge is I think I really got stuck in a rut where like that's the way I've looked at everything. And it was very difficult for me to shift my perspective out of that, of all the things that we could be better at, all the things that we were theoretically doing wrong, all the opportunity costs of things that we hadn't been yet achieving. And that was having a very negative impact on my personal life, on, I think, my happiness, my ability to be a great father and spouse to my wife. And so I think once I recognized that, I then, you know, tried to figure out, all right, what are mechanisms that I can do to help evolve my perspective? And without going down the litany of things like learning how to meditate and or hiring coaches to help me learn how to manage my own psychology better or try to take a different perspective. And I think to your point, one of the most powerful things has been, or for me personally, has been learning how to show gratitude and really feel gratitude and really take stock of where we are and remember what my perspective like or experience was like at different points along the way. And so, like, as an example, as the 25-year-old who loved games, who was dreaming of starting a company and creating a business plan, I would never have imagined that League or Riot could be anywhere close to as successful as it is today. And when I'm able to put myself back in that mindset and perspective, which I can do with some focused effort, I feel a tremendous sense of gratitude. And then it makes me want to go interact with my employees in a different way. It makes me want to say thank you to our players in a different way. It makes me want to appreciate my business partner in a different way. It makes me want to appreciate my wife and my family and everybody who is put up with my relentless obsessive focus or missing family events or not calling when there was a challenge in their life because I was busy doing different things. And so I'm really trying to cultivate the capability to do that more. And so in some ways there's kind of a metaphor where I feel like it's been climbing a mountain where most of the day to day you kind of have your head down and you're taking one foot in front of the other and it's really unsexy. And you look up and you crest one rise and there's a bunch of more mountains ahead of you. But periodically you also can look back and you're like, oh my God, like we've come a long way. And I'm trying to do a better job of that, right? Remembering to look back. And then when we do look back, not just do it for myself, but pause to recognize and celebrate and appreciate everybody's been along the journey. And I think it's a critically important perspective. So thank you for the question.
Beautiful answer too. I love it. So Mark, I apologize that we didn't get to Mark in his spare time, I should call it, with two small children and co-chairing a company still, that you do serve on the board of several nonprofit organizations. We didn't, unfortunately, get a chance to talk about those, and it's not to detract from it at all. I will link to all of those and do like a small write-up on each on the show notes for everyone, so you can go see what Mark is up to and what he feels outside of business is worth his time, energy, and resources at this point. RiotGames.com is the main site. Mark is on Twitter at Mark Merrill. I'll also link to that in the show notes for you, so it's easy for you to find. Is there anywhere else people can connect with you, Mark?
I also have an Instagram account, which is the Mark Merrill Official at Instagram as well.
Nice. Awesome. We'll also find a link to that, and we'll link it up in the show notes for you. So once again, Mark, thank you so much for joining me today. Sorry I took so much of your time. I do truly appreciate, though, your openness with it. And I don't know, just keep doing what you're doing, man, because what you've accomplished has been amazing, and I look forward to seeing what you do in the future.
Well, thank you, John, and I appreciate what you do. You know, I think helping entrepreneurs succeed is the lifeblood of society in a lot of ways, right? I mean, and so anyway, I'm so grateful for everyone that's on the entrepreneur journey and trying to make their industry or their products or people's lives better in different ways. And so thank you for helping everybody improve.
All right. So that was, as I said, that was about 20, 25 minutes longer than we typically go on the show, but it just seemed like it needed to go places that we hadn't quite, I'm going to say, concluded on or wrapped up well enough to just end the episode. So we went straight for it and I hope you dig it. Also feel free to let me know if you like a style a little bit longer or not. But just if you have never been here before, I want you to know that typically we run about 30, 35 minutes for an interview. So hacktheentrepreneur.com, it's the website. It's where everything is hosted. You can get onto the email list over there, and you can also find a link to the show notes under podcast. You'll find Mark Merrill, and we'll link to everything he said, as well as we'll provide some more info that we have on Mark, on Riot Games, and on League of Legends. That's all there for you. Whenever you have time to head over there, go on, check it out. And we've also got a blog, we've got courses, we've got everything you could possibly want to help you start, grow, build your own online business. All right. Thank you so much once again for joining me. I truly, truly appreciate it. And until next time, please keep hacking the entrepreneur.